KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro in for Scott Schaefer. On today's show, one of the state's top political leaders weighs in on the crisis involving Central American children crossing the U.S. border. Also, after a fracking ban died in Sacramento, activists get busy at the county level.
We figure that if we pass these initiatives in November, dozens of counties will be filing their initiatives, and it can even be done on a city level.
Plus, what's more natural a combination than football and rock and roll?
I love it. I love football, and I think this is great. I love everything about the atmosphere and everything. When I come in here, I'm so excited just to be here.
And we remember Charlie Hayden, a jazz giant who became a major influence for musicians of all kinds in Southern California. It's the California Report. Six California legislators are in Central America this week, visiting El Salvador, Guatemala, and Panama. The trip was planned months ago, but it's taken on new urgency in the wake of a surge of unaccompanied children migrating to the United States. The California Report's Tyke Hendricks has more.
It was originally planned as a trade delegation, but with a record 58,000 children detained at the U.S. border in the past 9 months, the California lawmakers arrived in El Salvador to also make sense of a humanitarian crisis. State Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg said the region's political leaders feel deep responsibility for halting the fleeing children.
They recognize that the root cause of the problem is the security situation in their own countries, in addition to the economic challenges in these countries.
He said Salvadoran leaders are trying to make investments in education and economic development, but they struggle with a lack of resources.
Ultimately, people will stop seeking to migrate to this country, taking this dangerous journey, if they have some hope about their own futures where they live.
Steinberg said targeted U.S. assistance could be cost-effective in the long run, reducing the burden on the Border Patrol and immigration courts. For the California Report, I'm Tyke Hendricks.
This situation has been years in the making. The California Report's Scott Schaefer sat down recently with David Shirk, director of the Justice in Mexico Project at the University of San Diego, and asked him to explain the root causes.
Well, I think we've paid a lot of attention in the last few years to the wave of violence that has hit Mexico. But what many people haven't realized is that that wave of violence has been region-wide in other parts of the hemisphere, and particularly in Central America, in places like Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
What's driving it now?
Some of the drug trafficking activity, organized crime activity, has really stretched from Mexico into some of these other places, which already had their own difficulties, the prevalence of gangs, some of which span international boundaries, the MS-13, but also the interaction, I think, of some of that local activity in Central America with Mexican organized crime groups that have been operating and active in some of these places, notably in Guatemala, where for a number of years we believed Chapo Guzman, the most notorious drug trafficker of Mexico, was hiding out, where the Zetas, the notoriously ruthless paramilitary drug cartel, was operating.
And to what extent is California the source of any of these problems, like, for example, the drug gangs you alluded to?
The MS-13, Mara Salvatrucha, are a transnational gang that was originally developed by El Salvadoran kids that were fleeing civil war and conflict in their home country back in the 1980s, came to the United States, formed gangs as a form of self-protection, and then as they were deported, continued to have those ties and allegiances back home and sort of perpetuated those gang organizations. So in some ways, this is a problem that started here in California that's coming back to bite us decades later and illustrates that we can't simply deport our way out of an immigration problem.
It seems like really the last time Central America has been on the radar for us in the U.S. was in the 70s and 80s when all those civil wars were happening. What do you see, if any, as being the connection now with those civil wars?
I think it's directly connected. I mean, for some of these kids, they were born into a period of civil unrest and insurgency and strife in their home countries. And unfortunately, after we stopped paying attention to Central America after the 1980s and early 90s, unfortunately, we kind of abandoned the situation there, and we didn't invest heavily in educational programs, economic development programs that would help to lay a foundation for a lasting peace in those places.
As you know, some in Congress, Republicans primarily, are saying that the president and his policies are to blame for this. Things like a program known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which grants undocumented kids a reprieve from deportation, maybe a work permit if they're eligible for that. What role do you see that playing in luring more kids, a kind of a carrot to have them come north to the U.S.?
For a lot of these kids, they have no idea what the deferred action is. I think those reports of people receiving the message that there would be some kind of amnesty or protection for kids coming to the United States were greatly overblown. And when you look at the data, places that these kids are coming from are the places where we see the most violence. In fact, the wave of increase of unaccompanied minors really began well before the deferred action program was even thought of.
And finally, Professor Shirk, looking ahead, what do you see coming? How do you see this being resolved, if that's even possible, in the months ahead?
It would not take a lot in terms of U.S. aid and assistance to help make these communities safer places so that they don't have to come here to the United States. I would imagine that for a fraction of what we spend on border security, we could help to develop counter-gang programs, after-school programs, workforce development programs in many of these countries that would have a far more lasting effect in protecting these kids and preventing them from coming here to the United States.
All right. David Shirk is director of the Justice in Mexico Project at the University of San Diego. Professor Shirk, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Opponents of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, have pushed for a statewide moratorium on the controversial oil production technique. Those efforts haven't gotten far, so now activists are taking the fight to the local level. KQED science reporter Lauren Summer tells us about several California counties where voters will decide the future of fracking in November.
In May, a bill hit the floor of the California State Senate that was all too familiar to legislators.
Let's lift the call on file item 40.
A statewide moratorium on fracking until the potential impacts are studied. Both sides stepped up to the microphone.
We have seen all sorts of fundamental environmental degradation.
We oppose Senate Bill 1132. In Kern County, we've been safely fracking for decades.
The votes were tallied.
Ayes 16, no 16. The measure fails for the second time.
The second time this year and for the fourth year in a row. So with little traction in Sacramento, anti-fracking activists are going county by county.
We're going to use glitter.
In a parking lot in San Juan Bautista, an hour south of San Jose, Kate Woods and other volunteers are painting huge cardboard signs that read,
"Protect our water. Ban fracking in San Benito County."
The group is called San Benito Rising, and they've put a fracking ban on the county's November ballot. Andy Shah-Coran spearheaded the effort.
We collected enough signatures to qualify in 14 days, which was maybe a state record.
Oil companies use fracking to squeeze more oil out of rocks. Water mixed with sand and chemicals is injected underground at high pressure to create tiny fractures. The sand props open the cracks so the oil can flow out. The thing is, so far, oil companies haven't been fracking here.
And we don't want you to frack in San Benito County. You know, we know that this is a county with a lot of oil potential.
Shah Koran says the push for local control is happening across the country. Cities in Colorado and New York have banned fracking over concerns about groundwater contamination and land impacts. Shah Koran is collaborating with activists there and with others in California.
We see a battle for sure, but we also see a great opportunity.
Rebecca Clausen is with Santa Barbara County Water Guardians, a volunteer group that's put a fracking ban on the Santa Barbara County ballot. We're on the coast near Clausen's house, where large oil platforms sit just off the beach.
Home of the first major oil spill in the United States. In 69, there were hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil pouring into the ocean and washing up on these beaches here.
Clausen says the spill and concerns about impacts on local agriculture helped her group gather signatures faster than expected. The oil industry in both Santa Barbara and San Benito counties has also turned out in force with concerns about jobs. That includes Armin Nahabedian. He runs Citadel Exploration, a company that develops oil projects.
We'll move in our rig to initially drill just across the road there.
Today, he's talking with rancher Skip Ramsey about putting an oil well on his land outside of San Ardo, an hour south of Salinas.
Okay. Now, Stan, you don't graze your cattle over there very often?
No, not so much. They generally travel through it to get to the better areas.
The drought has hit Ramsey's ranch hard. The hills turned brown months ago. He says royalty payments from an oil well would go a long way for his family and his ranch.
To just support college educations, and I'd like to increase my water capability to raise more feed for my cattle.
Nahabedian says if the San Benito measure passes, it could stop deals like this one. The problem isn't fracking, he says. His company doesn't use it. It's that the initiative would also ban another oil extraction technique called cyclic steam injection. California's oil is heavy stuff, so producers inject steam underground to loosen it up.
It's not much different than, you know, cleaning a dirty engine block to try to clean the oil off of your engine. You could just steam clean it.
About 60% of the oil produced in California comes from steam injection and similar methods. It's far more common here than fracking. Nahabedian says banning steam injection would mean the state's refineries would have to get oil from elsewhere.
I'm a veteran from Operation Iraqi Freedom, and I have a firm belief that it's our social responsibility and our civil responsibility to become a domestic producer that is totally independent of foreign oil supply.
Nahabedian points out the state is developing new regulations for fracking, ones that will ensure it's done safely, he says. But those regulations aren't enough for activists like Andy Shah Koran.
We figure that if we pass these initiatives in November, that dozens of counties will be filing their initiatives, and it can even be done on a city level.
In May, Santa Cruz County supervisors passed a fracking ban there. Voters in San Benito and Santa Barbara counties will vote on bans in November. Activists in Butte and Mendocino counties are still working to qualify ballot measures. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Sommer.
It's not every day you go to a sporting event and a concert breaks out, but that's exactly what happens when the LA Kiss plays at home in Anaheim. The Arena Football League team is owned by Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley of the band Kiss. As the team gets ready to wrap up its inaugural season, Susan Vallett explores the appeal of pairing football with rock and roll.
An electric guitar player in tight black pants shakes her long blonde hair like a rock star. Her red guitar matches the flames in the Kiss logo in the center of the gray field. It's loud. It's wild. The Kiss brand is everywhere. behind the end zone in the form of Gene Simmons, who stands at the sideline, and in songs like their 1975 smash, Rock and Roll All Night, which play on heavy rotation. Denise Chavez says the team brings together two of her favorite things, football and KISS.
I love it. I love football, and I think this is great. I love everything about the atmosphere and everything. When I come in here, I'm so excited just to be here.
During breaks between plays, live entertainment ranges from an 80s cover band to the KISS Girls dance squad in black leather. Through the entire game, scantily clad women dance around poles and cages hanging over the end zones. That's right, pole dancers in cages.
I think it's fine, but other people think it's a little overboard.
Season ticket holder Raymond Mackey clutches a KISS doll that he bought as a little mascot.
I had one of my friends sit in my seats and turn around and said he was waiting for the kitchen sink to come out.
A few rows up, 71-year-old Barbara Rowlandson and her friend couldn't care less about the girls dancing or the music.
Oh, God, that one band, what was it? Rock Your Pelvis or Give Me Your Pelvis or something. It had something to do with it. I'm looking at her saying, did I hear that?
But Rowlandson says this is the only place she can come to watch live football when the colleges are in the off-season. There's no NFL in L.A. The Arena League plays during the spring and summer. Rowlandson and her friend bring earplugs to the games.
I'm going to go see a football game. Well, let's put it this way. Gene Simmons doesn't believe I should probably be out of the old age home, so I don't think he was looking for me to become a season ticket holder.
Still, Rowlandson says she understands the KISS branding to attract younger fans. USC sports business and media professor Jeff Fellinger says the KISS have come into a crowded marketplace. He says they need to set themselves apart.
You don't sell winning today when you market sports teams because you can't be guaranteed of winning. So you sell the fan experience. You sell entertainment. You sell fun.
Fellinger says the team isn't just competing against other sports. It's competing against movie theaters, concerts, even high-definition TVs.
Touchdown!
The LA KISS have a losing record, but fan Jeff McClure says that's okay.
There's always something going on, so even if we lose, which is sad, you still don't walk away going, I don't feel like I got my money's worth.
The LA KISS aren't the first arena football team in the LA market. The LA Avengers played here for a few years and then folded. But the LA KISS have something the Avengers did not, the pull of a rock band. For the California Report, I'm Susan Vallett in Anaheim.
Years of cuts to education, as well as parks and recreation, have left many parts of the state with a shortage of resources for sports and other activities. So it might seem like a no-brainer that a volunteer-built skate park in a neglected part of Oakland is just what the neighborhood needs. The problem is, it was built without permission. Andrew Stelzer explains.
A dead-end street in West Oakland's Lower Bottoms neighborhood runs right into a sidewall of the 880 freeway. For years, this was a vacant patch of concrete with an enormous pile of illegally dumped dirt filling a lot next door. Now, it's the scene of laughter, ollies, and kickflips. In late 2013, a group of skateboarders decided to create an oasis here, in this impoverished corner of the city.
I feel happy here. Nobody's bothering me. I'm not doing drugs. I'm not on a corner, so I'm going to waste my time doing some other stuff I shouldn't be doing in the first place.
Kevin Jenkins was one of the dozens of skaters and supporters who built the Lower Bob's Skate Park, nicknamed for the business next door, Bob's Warehouse.
We don't stop graffiti. We cleaned up a dump. We gave kids skateboards. For me, honestly, I never built a skate park in my life. I built one. I want to keep it.
But keeping Lower Bob's might not be so easy. It was built without permission, and according to Joe DeVries, assistant to the city administrator, it's faced numerous warnings to stop.
I came out when it was just a really small berm, and I said, you guys, you really need to stop.
this is, yeah, I'll try to help you on the inside. We'll try to make it legal. They said, okay, no problem. We'll stop. That was like on a Tuesday. On a Saturday, I drove by and they were fully going at it, construction. And I'm like, we're not building anything. I'm like, well, like there's the construction tool.
No trespassing signs were erected and ignored. A fence was put up and torn down. A skate park organization called Gauntlet stepped in to negotiate with city officials, which led to a neighborhood meeting in April. The majority of community members expressed support for what they see as a bright spot in a neighborhood plagued by violent crime and illegal dumping.
I feel like it has been an incredibly positive addition to the community.
Vlad Levitansky owns the 10th and Wood Cafe around the corner.
They're creating something, be it illegally, but you have all sorts of people that have come together working on something.
A video posted online chronicles the arduous construction of Lower Bob's. It's the latest in a tradition of DIY skate parks, some of which have been legalized in other parts of California. San Diego's Washington Street Skate Park was created in 1999, and after forming a nonprofit and negotiating with the city, now draws skaters from across the U.S. The Channel Street Skate Park in San Pedro was constructed in 2002.
I really think the thing that saved us from the get-go was just a really good working relationship with local government.
Skater Andy Harris is president of the San Pedro Skate Park Association. He says then-city council member Janice Hahn was an important ally. With moms dropping off minivans full of kids at Channel Street, it was clear the skaters had created a safe and important space.
She saw the benefit of community members coming together to build something that the city had completely failed to do.
K-Dub is a well-known skater and community activist who spearheaded the construction of Town Park, a legitimate skate park in West Oakland. At the neighborhood meeting, he said government bodies need to be more open to working with skaters, or they leave them with few options.
Oakland is about 7 parks underserved. And so when you don't serve that recreation, then you get folks who have access to trucks and concrete and skills, wood and labor to just do.
But the skaters have yet to find their champion inside the system. In the last 5 years, 2 other illegally constructed skate parks have been demolished in Oakland, although both were on land owned by Caltrans, not the city. City Councilwoman Lynette Gibson McElhaney, who represents the neighborhood, says she's willing to work with the skaters, but they need to change their approach.
There's a way that you come into a community respectfully. This isn't it. No matter how beautiful it is, this isn't a respectful way to arrive.
The skaters who built the park have agreed to stay away, for now. But with no one managing Lower Bob's, vandalism, drug use, and a homeless encampment have all appeared. In the meantime, the skate park organization Gauntlet is working to obtain insurance, inspections, and money to buy or lease the site. For the California Report, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Oakland.
Charlie Hayden died last week at the age of 76. He was one of the greatest bassists in jazz history, but that's not all. Hayden spent much of his life in Southern California, where he made his presence felt on and off stage as a band leader, educator, and patriarch of a sprawling creative clan. Andrew Gilbert offers this appreciation.
As the news of Charlie Hayden's death spread over social media, the most striking thing was how many musicians took his loss so personally. More than anything, his peers recognized Hayden as a creative force who helped change the face of jazz while infusing the music with his passion for justice. His passing wasn't a surprise. Complications from the polio he contracted as a child had been racking his body for several years. But even in his last performances, he could summon an entire world with a single perfectly placed note. Hayden arrived in Los Angeles in the mid-1950s as a Hollywood-besotted teenager, wide open to new sounds. After several formative years performing with piano greats Hampton Hawes and Paul Bley, he joined the groundbreaking quartet of Ornette Coleman. quartet's epochal 1959 run at the Five Spot in New York City left many jazz musicians perplexed by the group's unorthodox practices. With his oblique sense of harmony and intuitive approach to form, Hayden anchored the band's searing, blues-drenched flights with lines informed by the folk music on which he was raised. After narcotics sidelined him in the early 60s, Hayden eventually obtained sobriety, and there are many stories of him reaching out to help other musicians in crisis. His first album as a leader, 1969's politically charged Liberation Music Orchestra, featured arrangements by Carla Bley and drew on songs of the Spanish Civil War for inspiration. Over the decades, he reassembled the band whenever he felt the need to weigh in on American policy, like he did on The Ballad of the Fallen, a cry against U.S. involvement in Latin America. In the 1970s, Hayden played in pianist Keith Jarrett's Great American Quartet, and in 1982, he established the influential jazz studies program at Cal Arts. In duo and trio encounters, he could explore just about any style, meeting the musical needs of the moment with his passionate lyricism. Here he is playing with pianist Hank Jones from the 1995 album Steal Away, a project focusing on hymns, spirituals, and folk songs. Every time I got to sit down with Hayden for an interview, it was a memorable experience. But the first time was the most revealing. 20 years ago, for a feature in the magazine Musician, he gathered with his son Josh, then in the rock band Spain, and his triplet daughters Petra, Tanya, and Rachel, who were in the early stages of their musical careers. His kids talked about the various ways growing up with him influenced their music. But Hayden was quick to point out that they were influencing him too. Josh had introduced him to the LA post-punk scene. The band Firehose opened for the Liberation Music Orchestra at McCabe's in Santa Monica. "They asked me to sit in on a tune with them at the end," Hayden recalled. He wasn't concerned about musical styles. If he connected with the players, Charlie Hayden was always game.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. The technical producer is Seal Muller. Our engineering team includes Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. The online team includes David Weir, John Brooks, and David Marks. Our interns are Nancy DeVille and Angela Rowell. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Susie Racho, Kat Snow, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro in for Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.